Love in a Time of War.
For me, the two characters of Sam and then, you know, Helen, they don't know what they're, you know, getting into. I think Sam is further down that road as a journalist where he's been covering many wars, but this is kind of the war that defines him and the one that he kind of, you know, wants to break out of this cycle about journalists' ambivalent feeling that maybe that they're war profiteers. And Helen, you know, has more altruistic ideas.
That's Tatiana Soley. We talked to her about her terrific debut novel about Vietnam, The Lotus Eaters.
Largely, the book goes back and forth, alternating between their points of view. So you're in either his consciousness or hers. But as the book developed, I felt in some of these key moments where they begin to have a more nuanced relationship, I stayed in his mind because I just didn't want to nail it. I didn't want it to be like, in any conventional sense, a love story.
And that's David Rabe. His unconventional love story about the Vietnam War is Girl by the Side of the Road at Night. Both books were listed among the New York Times notable books for 2010. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Valentine's Day is just around the corner. So in honor of that fact, we feature two love stories that cross the boundaries of cultures in the midst of war, the Vietnam War. Tatiana Soley's The Lotus Eaters is about a young American photojournalist, Helen, who finds and loses two very different loves in the crucible of war. She also finds another passion, her work, and confronts the moral dilemmas it carries. What happens to you when you make your living out of the suffering of others? Does it mean you are complicit, a war profiteer? Or, by reporting truthfully, can you help to end the suffering? The Lotus Eaters begins with the last scramble out of Vietnam after the Tet Offensive, as Helen grabs one of the last helicopter flights out of the country. The novel then flashes back to tell you how she got there. Her first forays into the field of combat, her love affair with an older journalist who becomes her mentor, and the Vietnamese man who is friend to both and whom she marries. It's a spellbinding story, solidly grounded both in the emotional lives of its characters as well as in a true-to-life portrait of the time and place of the Vietnam War. Tatiana Soley is too young to have lived through that war, unlike our second guest today, David Rabe, who fought there. But she has nailed it. The Lotus Eaters made it onto the New York Times bestseller list and was also on its list of 100 notable books for 2010. Tatiana Soley, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Now, you write on your website that you have always been interested in the Vietnam War. Why is that?
I think it was when I was a small child. My mom worked for NATO in Naples, Italy. And she was then transferred to, she got another job at Fort Ord in Monterey, California. So we were in the late 60s, we were living on a military base while the war was going on. And even though I was a small child, you know, all of her friends and all of my friends, their parents, you know, were involved in the war. And so I think, you know, when I grew up, I was always fascinated and I always read everything I could, kind of trying to understand that period in our life.
And now you've written just a stunning novel about it, The Lotus Eaters. For those of our listeners who might not know the reference, first of all, what does The Lotus Eaters refer to, and why did you choose that as your title?
It's out of the Odyssey, and the sailors are you know, that have been out to war for years, and they're on their way home, and they talks about the boat stopping on an island, and it's the land of the lotus eaters, and the natives feed them this honeyed fruit, and when they eat the honeyed fruit, they forget about their hurry to go home. It's kind of a narcotic. They forget all thoughts of going home and stay there. And I thought it was it just was one of those things that I came across at the same time as I was thinking about the book. And I think, you know, it kind of explains the characters that get caught up in doing this war coverage and get caught up in being in Vietnam. And they don't have the natural instinct to leave it.
You have three unforgettable characters. You have the protagonist, Helen Adams, who comes in as a freelance war correspondent and goes out as a celebrated one. You have Sam Darrow, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent, who she has a love affair with. And then his assistant, who becomes her assistant and then becomes, I think I can say safely, her husband, because I has been revealed in reviews.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Vietnamese, Lin. Is war a narcotic for, let's just say, the Americans here in some way, like the Lotus Eaters? Is war itself?
I do. I mean, for me, the two characters of Sam and then, you know, Helen, because she's the last one on the scene, they don't know what they're, you know, getting into. I think Sam is further down that road as a journalist, where he's been covering many wars, but this is kind of the war that defines him and the one that he kind of, you know, wants to break out of this cycle, you know, which I kind of discuss in the book about journalists covering, you know, having this ambivalent feeling that they are contributing and gaining. They're war profiteers, in other words. And Helen, you know, has more altruistic ideas, but, you know, I think she goes down that same road. And the kind of the opposite of that is somebody like Lin, who, you know, has been devastated by the war, and this is his home. And so, you know, he has no choice to be there. And I think he's kind of their moral compass that through their relationship with him, they kind of, you know, see where they are on that continuum.
So tell us about these three characters. Let's start with Helen. Who is she? Why is she there?
You know, she's kind of the innocent. She's the lens that I, you know, enter this world with, and then I, you know, she's a proxy kind of for the reader. So, you know, she goes there for a whole mixed bag of reasons, which I think is, you know, while many of us do things that we can't explain, you know, part of it is that, you know, she comes from a military family, and she, you know, she feels like this is the thing that defined her father and her brother who died in Vietnam, and she wants to go there and understand what happened and understand, you know, what war is about and everything. And she develops her own career, and she kind of, you know, grows as a person, you know, through this very strange thing, not only going to a foreign land, but going there at a time that it's upside down and it's not itself. And so she kind of finds herself, and she also comes to understand things that it becomes a much bigger thing than what she set out to do.
Now, she has a debut into the theater of war, where she falls flat on her face. Could you describe what happens and what is, why did you write it in that way, that she fails so miserably at first?
I think as when you read a book, I think it's, I could have had her be a real professional who had covered other wars. One of the models that I had, because when I first discovered that women were covering, you know, combat photography in Vietnam, was Dickie Chappelle, and she had covered World War II. So she was a seasoned, you know, journalist. She had been out in the field. She knew what it was like to be with the troops. You know, she liked to go with the Marines all the time. And I felt that for me, it was more important to have somebody who has no idea what they are doing. And, you know, it's an absolute shock, because there's a huge difference between watching it on television and you know, thinking that you can do something, and then to actually be there. And so kind of the shock of the reality of it, and also, you know, she suddenly realizes, my God, I'm doing something that I can't even load the camera. And it sounds a little far-fetched, but especially during that time, all the books that I read and the research I did on the journalists, a lot of real amateurs did go there, and they didn't know anything about cameras, and they went on to become some of the most famous photographers of war of all time, and especially of the Vietnam War. So I thought that was so interesting to explore that kind of, you know, craziness that you would go to do something that's life-threatening and with no equipment, no knowledge.
And incredibly brave. I mean, she's there. She doesn't just not know how to load the camera. She forgets she has a camera in that first, when she's thrown out right onto the war scene for the first time, and the very terror. I mean, I think you write that incredibly compellingly, the terror that she feels and how, you know, everything is really driven out of one's mind. It's completely natural. You know, there you are, you're just trying to survive.
Yeah, I mean, it's unimaginable for, you know, those of us who've never been under those circumstances. But, yeah, I think that would be a natural instinct. And what's really almost unnatural but amazing is the people, the photographers that go into these kind of conditions and just act like a professional and just do their job, and they're ignoring, you know, that is, you know, highly dangerous, and they could die at any minute. And, you know, Sam is at that point where he's enjoying himself and he wants to go again and again. And so she makes this kind of personal journey between being too scared, you know, to remember to take a picture of the reason she's out there, to being more like Sam.
Yeah, and it happens at a pivotal incident where she's witness to an execution of an old villager. Is it okay? Can you tell us about that? I don't think it really would take away from the suspense of the book.
No, of course. You know, she's gone out on a couple of missions, and then, you know, and she's getting battered around and kind of, you know, ignored and made little of because she's a woman. And so she goes out, and this is the first actual thing that she captures on film where, you know, Americans go into a village, and also the South Vietnamese troops are in a village, and they, you know, terrorize the villagers. And, you know, an incident happens that kind of reveals what the real story is of the war compared to the story that, you know, is being told. And she happens to be the one who can capture that. And so there's the utter horror that she's, you know, her innocence is really being taken away because she sees what's happening. This is not, you know, the altruistic, you know, thing that you would read when you're back home. And she is in the position that she took the picture. And ironically, this is what makes her famous. And so if she had just been an observer and she saw something like this, maybe she would be disillusioned and she would go home. But instead, she becomes famous because she witnesses it, and so she wants to stay there even more. So there's this horrible kind of sickening push and pull that the darker the war gets, you know, the more she benefits from it in a strange way.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with Tatiana Soli about her debut novel, The Lotus Eaters. It tells the story of a young American photojournalist who becomes involved with another American journalist and his Vietnamese assistant. Along with this evolution of her as a photographer, that is, in terms of her skill as a photographer, her maturity as a photographer, also comes this deepening understanding of the war, and that leads her into some pretty thorny moral territory. You alluded to it a little bit up at the start of the interview. Say more about how she confronts her own role as a photographer, an American photographer, in this, I think we could say, colonial war.
Yes. I think the interesting part about it is that what's fascinated me about Vietnam, as opposed to, you know, maybe doing a novel about a more current conflict, is that the wars before that, most of the coverage, you know, was patriotic, and they portrayed, you know, our side as, you know, the heroes, and that we were doing the good job. And, you know, the military and the government in the early days were saying that we were, you know, saving this country for democracy, and that we were, you know, the good guys. And this is one of the first times where the journalists actually saw something totally different on the ground, and they took pictures that turned public opinion back home. And so they did become the villains. I mean, the military thought that they lost the war because of the journalists being allowed to see things that they shouldn't see. And so there's a question for Helen, is that because she's recording this stuff and you know, getting famous off it and getting covers, is she benefiting and taking advantage of the situation in the same way as the military is? And I think it's a question that, you know, photographers always ask themselves. And I think, you know, what she comes up with and why she keeps on going is that if she doesn't cover it, that these atrocities and these things that happen will, you know, be buried forever, and nobody will ever know about them. And when she records them, and they go out into the world, you know, maybe she can, you know, change things. So in a way, it's a very altruistic impulse, I think.
Do you think she covers the war differently because she is a woman than she would if she were a man?
You know, the way that I have her as a character, I really wanted to experience, you know, what she wants to cover and why it's important to her. But when I was doing research on a journalist, and especially a quarter of the journalists that are covering Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan are women, and a lot of them talk about that they do cover different things, that they are more interested in the civilian story, and that is the part that they wanted to cover. And one particular photographer said she did not want to be embedded with the troops because she wanted to be there and to get the other side of the story. So I think women are more naturally interested in that type of thing. You know, obviously it's a stereotype. You know, a lot of men would cover that also, but I think a woman is just naturally going to see the cost of war more and not be caught up in the heroics of battle or soldiering.
Mm. We're talking with, and I'm pre-taping this, but I'll ID you. We're talking with Tatiana Soli, right?
Mm-hmm.
The emphasis is on the first syllable?
Soli.
Okay. We're talking with Tatiana Soli. And this is your first novel, it looks like.
It is.
You've written short stories before this.
Yes, this is a long project for me. I've worked on it, you know, off and on, pretty much 10 years before, from you know the first idea until it got published.
Wow!
I cut my teeth on this one, but it was a very big project to take on.
Well, it's incredible, really, for a debut novel. It's a superbly written piece of work. It's called The Lotus Eaters, and it's about a foreign correspondent, a woman, in Vietnam. Now, you have this other character, Lin. Well, you have two other characters, but let's move to Lin, because he, of course, is somebody who has suffered terrific loss as a Vietnamese, and she becomes, Helen, your character becomes intimately connected with him. Talk about who he is and how their relationship unfolds.
One of the goals I had for this book, when I'm writing in the, you know, body of work that's written about Vietnam, is that I really wanted to give a sense of the country and of the people and of the culture that was, you know, being destroyed. And a lot of the excellent works that have been written, you know, from the soldiers' perspective. And so they're not going to have that, you know, the breadth to go into this area. And so it was really important to me to have a character who could naturally educate Helen, the main character, and that way the reader could learn about what had actually happened before the Americans ever got there, and you know what state the country was at before then, and what happened when they were there. And Lin is that character. He is affected. His parents are affected. He loses his whole family, and he's kind of, you know, he's a war casualty before they ever get there. And I modeled it a little bit after a famous Vietnamese Times correspondent who was a spy for the North Vietnamese. My character is much less dramatic than that, but I wanted to show that kind of the torn loyalties that he has, because you know he does love Helen and he loves Sam and he does work with them all the time, so he has a natural loyalty towards that. But he understands and he kind of tells them throughout the novel that they are not seeing the real cost that is happening, and they're not seeing, you know, the devastation. And so he's a torn person, and through him, Helen learns, you know, about the country and about the people. And so I think it makes her a better person and a better journalist. And I think hopefully, so when you finish the book, you'll understand more about the culture of Vietnam, which makes, you know, the war that happened there a lot more meaningful, I think, than if it just happens in an unknown place with unknown people.
Yes, and you make it really come alive. I mean, your prose, just a descriptive prose, is so evocative in this book. And also, these characters are so real. I mean, Lynn, you know, he's a patriot in some ways. He's also, maybe not to the extent of the character on the person on whom he's based, but he's involved with giving information. He becomes a kind of double agent. And so it seems to me that all these characters are struggling with the moral ambiguities that we all face just in the course of living.
Mm-hmm. I think another reason that Lynn is kind of, maybe, like you said, a double agent, I think the interesting thing is that a lot of the Americans that would go there, they would say, well, we want to, you know, are these people loyal to us, or are they disloyal, or are they on our side or not? And I wanted to put in all the shades of gray that I think somebody like him could actually think he's being very loyal to these people, even though he's lying to them and being a double agent, that they don't have the same ideas that we did, because during the war, a lot of the Vietnamese didn't really care which side they were on. They were trying to survive. And I think that's something that, you know, coming from the outside, coming as an American, you don't necessarily see.
Right. You know, I want to ask you, how did you achieve such incredible verisimilitude? I mean, I was never in Vietnam, but I read some comments from people who had been in about your book, and they said you just really hit the nail on the head. How were you able to do that?
Yeah, I think it's being a novelist, you have to be really obsessed with your material. And so because this was something that naturally interested me so much, I think I just tried to open it out and share it with the reader. And so I did a lot of research, but you know, I live in Orange County, California, where we have the largest Vietnamese, you know, population that came here from Vietnam. And I just am very interested in their stories and what they were going through. And I think I cared so much that I'd really tried to get it right through research and through, you know, hearing stories and trying to put it all together.
So you talked with people, Vietnamese, who had been there?
Yeah, I mean, there's such a big community here, and they all, you know, most of them left with nothing and came to this country. And so to hear that kind of struggle and to hear what they went through, you know, it meant a lot to me. I mean, my mom, you know, came to the U.S. to become a citizen, and I was a little girl, and she took me with her. And so, you know, the immigrant story is something that, you know, I have a real deep resonance with. But of course, it's so much more amplified if you're you know, leaving a country, you know, against your will and losing everything and coming to another place.
Yeah, we should say to our listeners that you, Tatiana Soli, you were born in Austria.
I was, uh-huh. Well, mom is Hungarian.
How old were you when you came here?
I was 4, actually.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Early enough for this to really be your home, but old enough to remember something of the old world.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my mom lost her parents in Hungary when she went to Austria, and so, you know, the displacement and the dislocation is kind of a theme that I understand through my family.
Hmm. We're talking with Tatiana Soli about The Lotus Eaters. Her novel is set in Vietnam during the war. Have you had any reaction from any of the Vietnamese that you spoke with or the Vietnamese community to your book?
It's interesting. I think a lot of them feel really honored that I portrayed them. I mean, one of the main characters in the book is Vietnamese, and I really tried to portray somewhat the complexity of their struggle and what their country was and what was lost. And so I think a lot of them said that they really liked that, and they liked that I tried to portray it in a I don't know what I would say, even-handed way, but I did put their side of the story in there. I did not try to write a political book, and, you know, it's a very human book. It's just set in the wartime. But I think overall that it's been a positive response.
And have you had any response from GIs who were over there, veterans of the war?
I talk to a lot of veterans when I go out and do book readings, and It's kind of fascinating. I would say for the Vietnamese community that lives here, And for the veterans, the war is a much more a current and alive thing. It's not so far in the past. It's not historical like it is for many other people. And so they talked to me, and they said, wow, this, you know, brought me back. And, of course, it's very painful for a lot of them. And they said, you know, even though I kind of resisted reading it, you know, once I read the story, you know, I was happy that I had. And, you know, it does kind of, you know, without going into, you know, long, gory battle scenes, I think I brought out what the war does to people. And they said that they, you know, felt some of the things that they had felt. So I felt honored.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is not just a war story, it's a love story. And love and war, of course, are often paired. Can you say something about the intensity of love, the development of these two great love affairs within the context of war? How does that make them different than if they were peacetime love affairs?
Well, there are a couple of interesting things. That Saigon, when people were going there, there was actually a civilian population that lived in Saigon that was servicing the military and all of the projects that were going on. So you could actually live an almost normal life in Saigon while the war was going on outside in the country, mostly. And so you could have a normal life. And a lot of the journalists that were based there, you know, they did live, you know, significant portions of time there. And so I think it's natural that you make connections with people that you're sharing, you know, your life with, just like you would in any other situation, you know, in the workplace. But obviously, when you're risking your life and when you're doing something so dangerous, I think it becomes a more and more narrow experience. And especially when you start, you know, I guess, being shell-shocked or traumatized by it, there are fewer and fewer people that you can share it with. I mean, a lot of veterans will not talk about their experience to anybody who has not been through it. And I think that the journalists are a little bit that way, too. I think when my character, Helen, you know, does come back home, she feels like she can't explain what she went through, and not only the horror, but also the feeling of being really alive and being really doing something really important, and that it doesn't translate to anybody who wasn't there. And I think that's why she goes back.
You know, I read in preparation for this interview, I read something of Chris Hedge's essay on war. He, of course, was a war correspondent for most of his life as a journalist, and has been become a passionate, very radicalized person as a response, anti-war. And he says, you know, he feels that the role of the war correspondent has been to feed us the myth of war, and that his life has been deformed by this organized industrial violence at the same time that he felt the attraction of that violence. So attraction, there's that word attraction. Attraction goes with love. This kind of twinning of violence and love, is that some of what you're talking about here?
It definitely is. I mean, because of when the book came out, a lot of reviews compared this book, you know, to The Hurt Locker, where the soldier, you know, he can't leave what he's doing, and nothing else, you know, is as interesting. And I definitely think there is not like a soldier, you know, the allure of combat, but even as a journalist, there's an excitement level and a feeling that you're doing something really important, that nothing else, it's a narcotic that nothing else can really, you know, in ordinary life can really compete with. It's kind of a heightened way of living. And you just don't want to, I think the journalists, and especially somebody like who you're talking about, you don't want to be used when you're trying to do, you know, good work, or be used because you're wanting to cover this type of stuff. And so you feel like maybe by doing your job really well and becoming famous, you're also furthering the war, furthering other people's ends.
Well, the book is The Lotus Eaters. We've been talking with the author, Tatiana Soli. It is just a terrific book, wonderful read. I wish you the best of luck with succeeding novels, which I hope you will be writing.
Thank you so much.
Tatiana Soli. The Lotus Eaters made it onto the New York Times bestseller list and was a 2010 New York Times notable book. It's out from St. Martin's Press. Soli has also published short stories, two of which were listed in the 100 Distinguished Stories in Best American Short Stories. Next up, David Rabe's novel, also set during the Vietnam War, is Girl by the Side of the Road at Night. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The Vietnam War has figured prominently in the work of David Rabe, whether in his work as a playwright, a screenwriter, or a novelist. He spent 11 months in Vietnam during his military service between 1965 and 1967, and he's perhaps best known for his trilogy of plays based on his experience of the war: the Tony Award-winning Sticks and Bones, The Basic Training of Pablo Hummel, and Streamers. Rabe also wrote the screenplays for the Vietnam War drama Casualties of War, as well as plays, novels, and screenplays about other subjects. Rabe's newest novel, Girl by the Side of the Road at Night, tells the story of the relationship that develops between a young American soldier and a young Vietnamese prostitute during the early years of the Vietnam War. It explores the boundaries between the characters, as well as the attraction and common humanity that pull them to each other. For me, the novel is most striking for how it's able to get inside the character of a poor, young, almost a child, really, Vietnamese girl, and the sensitive portrait the author draws of her. Rabe says the book isn't a conventional love story. In his review of the book in the New York Times, Philip Caputo wrote that it wasn't a conventional war novel. I started out our interview by asking David Rabe what he thought of Caputo's comment.
Well, I know what he means in the sense that in a standard war novel, or the, you know, what the term evokes is combat, bullets flying, and that kind of immediate and constant stress. On the other hand, the circumstances are very much created by a war environment, which he also kind of says that it's more of a, I think he alluded to something which I thought was quite eloquent about the war being a kind of expression of fate, and then referred to Thomas Hardy, which which was very true. I mean, that's very true.
How did you find that to be true?
Well, I mean, the book is very much about a kind of sense of fate that's created by the environment of the war, in some sense, as he put it. So, and that certain minor actions have huge consequences. Intentions don't bring the result they aimed at or thought they had, you know, thought they would directly cause. And so the ultimate kind of unraveling occurs as if ordained by some other force.
It's a tragedy, in a sense. And I think of this, you're a playwright, and I think of this in the dramatic sense almost.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something I could ever make a play out of, I don't think. Just because of the milieu and the detail that I wanted to put in, the kind of patience it takes for the story to develop. I mean, the indirection of a lot of it, and then suddenly there's, you know, a force of direction that causes brings about certain consequences, and you know, happens suddenly, more or less. But although it's all the book itself, I mean, in a play it would be very hard to do the kinds of scenes and develop them with the kind of detail and patience and kind of, you know, the environment of the book would be very different.
Right, and the environment is so powerfully detailed here. But let's take our listeners out of suspense and tell them a bit about the book itself, about the plot line of the book. And let's start with the characters. You have two main characters, both very, very different, except for the fact that they're both young. The first is Private Joe Whitaker, a truck mechanic working in a support unit in Vietnam. We first meet him stateside, and he's, first just tell us about him as we first meet him.
Well, Well, he's as the term is, come down on orders to go to Vietnam, and he, it's very, very early in the war. He will be one of the first, when they started building up the troops from very minimal numbers to the goal being ultimately 500,000, that started in late 65 and then happened in 66. And he's one of those. So there's very little information about what he's going to be getting into. He just knows there's a war going on, and he's going to end up. He's someone who allowed himself to be drafted. I mean, but it's prior to all the kind of stuff that people associate with the draft. And this was the standard draft. There was no lottery or anything. It was a peacetime draft up to that moment, basically. And then, so he's not very happy that he's been selected to go over there. He doesn't realize that, you know, he'll be one of hundreds of thousands. So now he's got a very restless, somewhat angry personality. He's from the Midwest, from Wisconsin, kind of a farm family, although the farm's no longer quite functioning, right? And his dad is ill. He's got a chip on his shoulder about various things. But also, I think, in spite of his anger and his so on, there's a deep decency struggling to find its way out and find an expression. But he's more or less committed to being probably tougher than he is.
Yeah, one really watches him, I think, throughout the book, struggling with himself. But, you know, especially in that first take, before he's really become challenged, as he does become so challenged later on, to reach more deeply into himself. Here's this, you know, young guy who's, you know, angry about a girlfriend who's broken up with him. She's gotten married, but he's still kind of attached to her. You know, he's really a welter of tender feelings and angry feelings, you know, kind of and very confused young man and kind of lonely. Is that right?
I think that's very good, yes. Yeah, it's probably more succinct than what I just went through and apt. So, yeah. You know, a lot of it is he's quite young, and I think a lot of that, both with the other character, Lon, too, they're very young and unformed in many ways, but put in situations that demand, you know, a character that they don't quite possess.
And tell us now about her. I mean, she, yes, also young, but seems as if she's much more connected to who she is at the core.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, Whitaker has a kind of dissonance with his brother at home, although he thinks he's affectionate, and he's very worried about his father, who's ill and in bed. And Lan is a young girl, a Vietnamese girl, who was raised on a farm. And again, all this occurs in 66, when a lot of the things that would later become kind of hardened and cynical, these were all kind of new at this point, and she's a farm girl who's now her father's dead, and she's working as a prostitute and to get by and also to send money home to her mother and other family members. And the place where she works is like a combo car wash, whorehouse, and where GIs can come in and Vietnamese soldiers can come in and have their vehicles washed by these young boys while then they get some sort of sexual service. But she has a kind of buoyant spirit that tries to find a way to make the best of all this. And I think she's got a deep sadness, too, about her life and her father, who she was very connected to, who simply was ill and died. I mean, it had nothing to do with the war.
Right, he had a heart attack. What strikes me is that in some ways these are two stock characters, you know, kind of the young, brash soldier and the Vietnamese young prostitute. And yet in reality, they are fully realized, very powerfully drawn characters. I can understand your deep understanding. I'm not saying that you are like Whitaker, but that, you know, you were a young American man who went to Vietnam between 1965 and 1967 yourself, but you've never been a young Vietnamese woman prostitute, and yet you were able to really climb into her character. How did you do that?
No, I'm not sure. It was major kind of, well, that was the challenge, if you want to call it that, or the thing I wanted to do more than anything else in the book. And I did it as carefully and as thoughtfully as I could. I did a certain amount of cultural research to be sure I was right about certain things. But then it's just a matter of feel and observation and seeing people that were there. And then, you know, you go in and you do the work you can and you try to avoid, you know, I tried very, you know, because you say that if you just state the young soldier, you know, a brash, a young Vietnamese who's a prostitute, there's a sort of conventionality that comes to mind, you know, which of course is true of almost any sort of character that you might name in that way, whether it's a stockbroker or whatever. So I worked very hard to, and drew on what I knew to define them based on the detail and the sort of very specific kinds of responses and moments of experience, and then did my best to imagine my way into the psyche and the cultural, religious psyche of someone and the kind of background that she has and the kinds of concerns about the family altar and her father and herself, which is a key thing in the book.
Because Vietnam had ancestor worship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a major part of the book has to do with her uncle wanting a photograph of her, because they put photographs on the altar when a person is deceased, and he's a very, very concerned about family arrangements and feels that everybody's getting all messed up and tossed about by the war, which they are, and that she's far from home. So this photograph becomes a very key element to the narrative and to the interplay between Whitaker and her.
We're talking with David Rabe about his novel Girl by the Side of the Road at Night, set in Vietnam early during the war. Among its themes is the surprising turns our lives take under the influence of fate. It's a story of the relationship between an American private and a young Vietnamese girl who works as a prostitute to support her family, and how that relationship both discomforts and changes them. Now, these are two vastly different people, and yet they are united by a common humanity and a bond that they discover, although it seems the reader feels the bond more from the perspective, from the voice of Whitaker, kind of how he, you know, struggles at first with, you know, just trying to see her as just a prostitute, but being drawn in almost immediately to a deeper sense of who she is and what she means to him. Why do you think he's so open to that? Is it?
Well, I think in a certain way, I think what you said is accurate, but he also is, I think a lot of the book is about, I think the reader feels and is aware of his sort of growing connection to her to a greater degree than he is. I mean, there's a kind of always a struggle and a desire to pull back and have a resistance to it and not really admit and not even acknowledge. I think partly he doesn't quite even know, you know, that this connection's happening. I think that's part of what I wanted to do with the book is that, and I think she there's a point where I just, you know, largely the book goes back and forth alternating between their points of view. So you're in either his consciousness or hers, and then, but as the book developed, I felt, and in some of these key moments you were just talking about, where they begin to have a more detailed or nuanced relationship, I stayed in his mind because I felt I just didn't want to. I didn't want to nail it. I didn't want it to be like, in any conventional sense, a love story. It's more like these two people who are in this wild circumstances. They're young. They have these feelings. They have these sexual desires, and then they are kind of flung into this, and they have an attraction, but they don't. With her, you don't know because I stay out of her point of view. Her behavior suggests that she's found something in him, but you really don't know because, you know, it becomes a kind of teenage. A lot of her behavior, you know, she wants him to buy trinkets and all that kind of stuff. There's no real manipulative greed to it, but he worries about that. And I try to keep it from, you know, falling into that. Well, it wasn't hard. I didn't to keep it from falling into a standard kind of love story because I didn't believe that's what it was about.
Well, what's striking to me in reading these sections is how the cultural difference plays a great role in the sense that it sows uncertainty and suspicion, certainly from his side, and one can imagine from hers. I mean, she's in the one down position, let's say, in terms of power. I mean, he has a lot more power than she does, although he doesn't experience her that way because he feels the power that she has over him. But, you know, I was stalked by this sense of danger and uncertainty here that I think they are as well.
Yeah, I think that, and that's sort of where, to refer back to the idea of fate and the sense that it, where it is in a war environment, I mean, there is threat, you know, the shadows are full of danger for both of them, and then they're not, you know, each day they get by, and but it's not like there's full-blown attacks going on or anything. It's all kind of nearby, and it occurs, and of course, then it does reach into violence and find them. But, you know, that area, the area where the book is set, is pretty accurate to that time. And then a couple of years later, or a year later, when the Tet Offensive hit, you know, it was... So if one of those nights when they were together, if the Tet Offensive had begun, you know, they'd have been in deep trouble. And the war would have, walked... That's where those places were attacked in force during the Tet Offensive. And now, so it's always lurking. And plus the cultural anger against, you know, from certain Vietnamese against her, other soldiers against him, because he is in the back and in the rear of the, not on the line, there's certain anger and resentment from combat, the guys who are in combat, who cross paths with him. You know, any of those moments could explode, and most don't. You know,
but then something does happen, which we won't go into. We'll leave
probably
that.
Not. I never know whether it's, because that's where the power lies,
yeah,
the whole event and ultimately where you're going and the story and how it happens and what's known about it and what isn't known. You know, but
well, we'll let the listeners read the book on that one.
Yeah, okay.
But I wanted to ask, first of all, how do you feel that his experience in being in Vietnam and in meeting Lan changes Joe Whitaker?
Well, you know, he certainly has a dawning of a certain kind of feeling and a certain kind of recognition of kind of what doesn't have, but it's never, and what, I mean, what he might begin to aspire to or welcome at some point in his life. But it's not, again, I don't make that a definitive part of the book. And in many ways, the way the book ends, he's just stepping, you know, he's in the army and he's doing what he's, his job. And it's very simple at the end, but, he's taken in, and he must rely on his fellow soldiers, which is the way it is, I mean, finally. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's something dawning on him, but again, the book doesn't in any way suggest that this experience, because in certain ways he remains, the reader knows many things that he doesn't about what's going on. And so he's in a puzzlement, actually, at the end of the book, and kind of dreaming of, you know, finding her again and so on. But hard to know, you know, what he would do, actually, the next step. I feel like the ending is one where you kind of accept and submit to the circumstances that he's in, which is very hard to when you're in a foreign country, you don't speak language, you know, there's a war going on.
Right.
Very hard to step away from, and the whole world, you know, you haven't gone there intentionally. It's not like you're on an adventure. You've been, you know, sent there and you're there and kind of thinking about getting home at some point. And so you're kind of caught up in that, and that's where he, in a sense, remains. Although I do think something will remain with him probably for the rest of his life about it all.
As we talked about earlier, to some degree, this is a story about fate. Fate is not an idea that's very comfortable to the American psyche, but anyone who has been in a war, I would imagine, would have done a whole lot of thinking about it. So I wanted to ask you, you know, how did your experience in Vietnam inform you on this issue or these questions?
Well, I think the first thing I would say that the Army, I was kind of the whole experience kind of forced a lot of what I would call goo or syrup off my and conventionality out of my way of thinking, and a sense of accident and decisions and how, you know, I mean, and my life has continued to unfold in ways that I can, you know, I don't continue to find that kind of dramatized or brought to the foreground often. I mean, I think we're in charge of some things, and then, you know, often our intentionality has consequences that are very different, whether there's a war on or not, you know, than what we set out to do. So it's something I just find myself thinking more about, trying to be thoughtful and careful about what happens, but knowing that often you are in, and what that force is, I have no idea. And sometimes it's just us figuring the wrong things out and thinking they're the right things and behaving along those lines. But and the war, I think, where I had a very, I think, more conventional point of view about many, many things that really got scraped off me and wiped out of me over the, as much after I started with Home and beginning to write and think about it.
And we're talking with David Rabe about his novel, Girl by the Road at Night. He's also a playwright, has written numerous plays, a number of them about Vietnam. How did the experience of you being in Vietnam and thinking about it and developing it through your plays and now this novel, has it evolved for you?
You know, I don't know how to say it other than that the plays themselves track a certain evolution and a certain way of thinking and a certain... There's four plays and they all have kind of very different perspective and almost a different theatrical style through which I guess I felt, instinctively wanted to examine or filter the experience and see how it looked through these different kinds of theatrical styles. I mean, Pablo is kind of realistic, but it's also a little surreal in structure. Sticks and Bones is quite surreal. The Orphan is far more of a kind of metaphysical play and tries to look at the whole violence and war in human life and sort of looks at Vietnam and then the following decade, 60s, through the perspective of the Oresteia. Dreamers is kind of more realistic in setting. It's realistic in appearance and in all style, although there are some developments dramatically in it that and how it works as a play that violate all the rules of the so-called well-made play. But it's still, in my view, what would be considered realistic. And then the novel was something I started also in that time frame, this novel. But I backed away from it at a certain point and only went back to it a couple of years ago.
When was that?
Why did I back away?
Yeah.
I didn't feel I could do it. I didn't feel I could finish it. I don't know exactly why. I didn't feel qualified. I didn't feel something. I just became very insecure about sort of my right to write it.
Is that partly because of Lan?
I think a big part of that. And also, I, like Whitaker, I was in a rear outfit. I was within a hospital unit. And I had a lot of what, you know, I felt invalid because I hadn't been in combat. That's a whole other story where I thought I wanted to volunteer and all that, but this is a kind of silly impulse, but impractical. I mean, you really can't do it. You can't just move from where you are. But I had I think I felt a little invalid too on that front in terms of that the book would be as it is without those elements. At that point, I thought, well, I can work something in where there's combat. But this time, when I went to work on, I knew I didn't want to do that. That really didn't belong to the story. I mean, you see casualties, and you see because he's at a hospital where he's working on the trucks. I mean, and hoping to work on the trucks, and you do see, you know, the sort of war reflected in on him through this large armada of helicopters going out into the jungles and then the wounded coming back. So there are events throughout where you see the sort of evidence of the carnage. But how it evolved, I really, is not something I know how to say. I just worked forward and did the plays. I did them all kind of off and on at once, began this novel, finished them at various times. Dreamers took a long time to finish.
Do you think you're done with Vietnam?
Other than a couple of little stories I think about every now and then. Yes, I would say I am.
Well, are you done with war, though? Because we're certainly not done with war.
No. You know, I don't know. I can't answer that, you know, definitively. I feel I'm working on something now that's hard to describe, but war exists in it. It's not a realistic novel, but it's a sort of fantastical novel. And there's a certain section that portrays apocalyptic development and
an apocalyptic development.
Yeah, but it's not. Again, I feel like everything I say will create the wrong impression about what it actually is.
So, are there certain things that you would just write in a play, certain topics or ways of tackling things that would fit better with a play and others with a novel? I mean, you said before that you couldn't really describe the environment in a play the way you do in this novel. So what would drive you to do a play versus a novel or vice versa? Or I mean, I'm not even sure if you can answer that, but I thought I'd ask it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, I think when I first started writing after the Army, I had been involved in theater before I was drafted, and I was involved in academic theater. But I also think a play is a more of a short burst, and a book, even a book that, you know, is not all that large, like Girl by the Road at Night, but is a bit of a more of a marathon. And I didn't have the psychological patience to write them then. But also, it's simply true that when an idea occurs, it usually comes as a play. It isn't like I get an idea and think, well, it would be better as a play or better as a, you know, novel or a story. They kind of come when they show up in your brain and you think, well, do I want to deal with that or what is that? And it has its, you know, its form with it. Those plays came as plays. And this was always a narrative of some kind, you know, whether it would be as big as it became or a novella, I never knew, but it was not ever something that appeared as a play. So it's not a decision I ever have to make. I don't think I've ever started something in one form and moved it to another, you know. They kind of have their identity with them when they show up.
And then there are short stories.
Yeah, and that's true, too, there. I mean, I did a novel a couple of years ago that I tried to make a story out of for a long time, and it wouldn't work. And then I just let it explode and became a novel. So,
which one was that?
It's called Dinosaurs on the Roof. It was came out about 4 years ago, I guess. Very different from these, set in the Midwest where I grew up, and two women characters, and a younger woman in her 30s who has problems, an older woman who believes she's part of a church that's going to be taken up in the rapture, and she enlists the younger girl to take care of her pets when she's gone, and then the book follows their lives and as these things unfold. But that I had tried to make that into a story at one point because it's based on an anecdote a friend who from the Midwest told me, but it wouldn't work. And then one day I was again fooling with this story, and these characters just took off, as they say, and especially the older people, and so I went with it, and then it really blossomed.
Well, David Rabe, your latest novel, Girl by the Road at Night, a novel of Vietnam, I think is one of the most powerful novels. A short one, a pithy one, a really profoundly human one, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us about it.
It's been my pleasure.
David Rabe's novel, Girl by the Side of the Road at Night, is published by Simon & Schuster. In addition to his works about the Vietnam War, Rabe is also the author of the novels A Primitive Heart and Dinosaurs on the Roof, and the screenplay for John Grisham's The Firm, among other works. To read excerpts from both Girl by the Side of the Road at Night and Tatiana Soli's novel The Lotus Eaters, go to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.